Welcome to The Vinyl Preacher, your weekly podcast where we talk about the Bible and make a playlist. I'm Matt Cadle, pastor at St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Zach Pierce. I'm the pastor of Lutheran Campus Ministry at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Well, it's the end of the world as we know it.
I don't feel good, Matt. I'm going to be real. I'd like to start.
Michael Stipe is full of shit. This is terrible.
This is no, I don't feel fine.
Not at all.
He assured me that I'd feel fine, and I do not feel fine, Matt. As we record today, let's go to the news. As we're recording today, last night, Russia aggressively entered, sounds like the fullness of Ukraine, and it appears that the end times are upon us.
Yeah, it's really bad. It's hard to stay fully abreast of all of the international news, but this one feels pretty big.
It feels really important to me.
Yeah. Yeah, Chris and I were talking last night, like, it's like in some ways we're kind of a unique generation where we grew up in like the 90s, where that post Soviet Union, hey, y'all, we're coming to the end of history. Like, you know, this is all, of course, we know it's nonsense, but still, like, it's very different. There are generations that grew up with war happening in Europe, that with people going off to war, like all this stuff happening. We're entering an interesting period. Even living in a post 9/11 generation sort of feels different than this. I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. I did see this morning that Russia's captured Chernobyl, which definitely feels great. That seems.
Oh my gosh. It's just this reminder, Matt, more than a reminder, that I think there is a pervasive idea that things that I've always believed, if not intellectually, then in my soul, right? That things just get better, right? Like everything is always getting better. That's always been my issue with liberal Christianity that has tried to avoid being called liberal and claimed progressive Christianity. You know, it's not true, right? Like there's no guarantee that things are always going to progress and get better. Like things aren't fated. Things happen because people make choices and people do stuff. Like that's why things happen, not because everything always gets better, you know, just because time passes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe that's a preaching way into it, you know, but
I wonder how we enter into this as religious leaders. I mean, obviously at one level, it's pretty easy to say war bad, peace good. Mm-hmm. But how do we move beyond that? How do we enter into the reality, you know, of what we're living through?
Yeah. No, I mean, and you're right. It feels so different than the post 9/11 stuff ever felt. That I don't think I've ever really seen like a nation state like openly just go into war against a nation state, really, right? Like the Gulf Wars and stuff, right? Were never, I mean, I don't know. It didn't feel like this, Matt.
Well, you have posted in our notes here a link that says if there's a war between Russia and Ukraine, it will be a religious war. I have not read it. What's it say, Zach?
Yeah, let me rundown. Here's the first thing I want to say. You know, big fans of the podcast, John and Hank Green of Vlogbrothers used to do with their biweekly missives to one another. They would occasionally do educational ones. And John did a very long one that got a bajillion trillion views on YouTube in 2014 on Ukraine. And he has since said that he regrets doing the video and they've stopped doing those because he's not an expert in Ukraine and that he simplified things that probably don't, that it's not helpful to get simplified into a 6-minute video. So with that disclaimer, Matt, I am not an expert on Ukrainian, on the Eastern Orthodox Church at all. There are many more people available to our listeners who know much more. But here's my quick summary of the article, never the less. And that is, of course, right, the Eastern Orthodox Church is the primary form of Christianity in that part of the world. You got to know the Patriarch of Constantinople is essentially functions something like the Pope of the Eastern Church. And underneath the Patriarch of Constantinople or Istanbul, or shout out to, they might be giants. There are essentially other churches that kind of function, you know, like your member churches of the Lutheran World Federation, or, you know, the way synods work within the structure of the ELCA. And for most of recent history, the church in Ukraine has been under the auspices of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is one of those. And the Patriarch of the Russian Church has increasingly been seen as the kind of polar opposite of the Patriarch of Constantinople, who has become the direction of the Patriarch has been in liberalizing the church, of course, in relative terms, in terms of like American social issues, but embracing science, that sort of stuff. And so the Russian Patriarch has been the anti person to that perspective. And in 2018, the Patriarch of Constantinople recognized the Ukrainian church as its own church. There's a fancy word for it, like made it an independent Selefi or something. And so that was considered, right, like a big shot against Russia and the Russian church, that they lost. The Ukrainian church became independent of the Russian church. So there's an intra-Orthodox struggle going on as well, that this is not a that I don't know how many of the speeches you've seen, right, Matt, but or listened to podcasts about all of Putin's speeches he's been making, right, and the vitriol of so much of it about the the disdain for the existence of Ukraine, denying that Ukrainian culture exists, that I sent you guys the silly meme that I think the U.S. diplomat ambassador to Ukraine published about how it was a picture of Moscow and Kyiv in 1015, and Moscow was woods. But it is certainly, if it's an attack on Ukrainian culture, which is certainly what it seems to be, there's a religious dimension to that. So again, you know, and I've, you know, again, Matt, no expert here at all, but I have been curious about the East and Russian stuff for the past couple of years, whether it's watching the highly entertaining and enthralling TV show The Great, which is like a funny take on Catherine the Great and her rise in Russia on Hulu, which you should check out because it's just entertaining. It might help us better understand what's going on. But also the great Catherine the Great HBO show that had Helen Mirren in it was really good as well. And I am reminded of a learning that sometimes I have to learn over and over again, that just because that Russia is different, and not just Russia, right? I learned it when I moved to Boulder and made a bunch of Australian friends, that just because Australians are white, the vast majority of them are white and speak English, we're not the same. Like there are cultural differences. And certainly that's true in Russia, that there are significant cultural differences, that even though what you and I remember is really formative memories of Russia is, you know, Boris Yeltsin and Russia getting McDonald's and like Russia's cool now, like everything's okay and we're all going to be cool now, like, so we're not different anymore. We don't have different cultures and cultural expectations, and that is not true. And for an American Western perspective that likes to think that religion is a thing people do on Sundays and can be excised from most substantive world issues, that's not the case.
Yeah, it is certainly a helpful reminder of how much I don't know. I spent too much time this morning reading background on Vladimir Putin that I didn't know. Friend of the pod, Francisco Herrera, who did Decolonize Lutheranism a while back, and activist in the church, he posted this great like PBS interview with this Putin biographer, and I read, I was like, there's so much I don't know about the world. That's true too. Like about what religion looks like in different places, right? And the thing is, like, we can't. I guess it's not as if it's our, like, you can't actually hold all knowledge in your head, right? But just that we approach these things with some level of humility, and a knowledge that we don't know what we don't know. But yeah, I like the way you approach that too, where it's like there are cultural differences that we are just not even aware of, right? And maybe one way that ties into this podcast is that's something that we've got to carry into these scriptures that we're going to study, is that there are probably cultural differences that we're like not even aware of. I say probably, not probably, there are. Mm-hmm. And so to be aware of that. and even in our preaching, you know, to be aware of that.
I mean, I wonder if a part of what, if the whole East versus West reemergence thing, you know, is not more helpfully understood as a religious struggle, that I hear the frustration from our political leaders, right? The Putin and Russia were never interested in a diplomatic solution. That they never took that seriously, and that our response, I mean, I just don't know what's going to happen, right? And our response is to like freeze assets and to make this economically painful for Putin and for Russia. Though I have to imagine that Putin assumed that is what's going to happen. And so like for us who are part of a religion where like, why would he do this if it's not in his economic interest? If this is going to be economically painful, why would he do this? Right? Like that's heretical that someone would do something that intentionally is not about, that would intentionally harm them economically. And it seems really clear that this is not an economic thing for Putin, that he has other religious and the kind of like lowercase r, like values that are driving these decisions, these actions.
Yeah. 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 No, that's super interesting. Cause at first I was going to say, I think it's more just human anthropology and horrible human nature than religion. But after listening to your wisdom, Zach,
bringing the wisdom,
it's the framework that we put on that human nature, right? It's the framework that we put on that, on our human anthropology, right? Like what is it that explains it? Is it our economic system? Well, people are going to act in their economic self-interest. Or is it like this sense of optimism that things are always going to move in gradually? No, they're not perfect right now, but they're always going to move in the direction of perfection.
Two countries with McDonald's will never go to war.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Like that's another way to understand human anthropology. And what is the anthropology that we're preaching on Sundays? Because it can very easily drift into one of those two, even if you don't intend it to. I've been reminded multiple times this week that I have maybe that pessimistic human anthropology that is my Lutheran upbringing has some merit, you know?
Right. Oh, man.
Well, we hold the people of Ukraine in prayer. We know that our words today are just us making sense of the whirlwind, but we continue to hold folks in prayer who are most impacted by this.
For sure. Well, you don't need any help this week bringing the vibe down for Ash Wednesday.
You don't. Are we going to talk Ash Wednesday? Are we going to talk? I guess we should start there, huh?
I suppose. I mean, I'd like to go back, Matt, as well to my one of my big breaks, Matt, in life was took a class called Public Theology through Chicago Theological Seminary with Susan Thistle-Thwaite, who at the time was writing pieces for the Washington Post, where her editor would send a prompt and she had to respond to it, a prompt that came out of current events and respond to it from a religious perspective. And so all the class was is that Susan would send us the prompt she got from her editor, and we had to compose a blog post. It was just a blog-based class. Blogs, for our younger listeners, were a thing in the aughts. They were wildly popular, and you had to have one, and I still have one. You can go to zachallpastor.blogspot.com to see the kinds of things I wrote in the late aughts and early teens before people stopped blogging and people stopped reading blogs. But we had to respond in a blog-based form, and if she really liked what you wrote, she would forward it to her editor at the Post. And so that is how I went from failing the English test at LSTC, literally spending the first semester in English as a second language, and then last semester I had a little piece published in the Washington Post. And you know what? That didn't just happen. That happened because I had to learn how to read and write in English. It wasn't progressivism. What I got to write about that made it into the Post was about nuclear disarmament, which is, turns out, important because Putin is leading this by talking about how large their nuclear arsenal is. Like this, like Matt, on this podcast, you and me, we are prone to dramatic hyperbole. All right. I will own that. Yeah. But this is really happening. Like that's what he led with. Like was yeah. like, Ukraine has never existed. It doesn't exist now. And I'd like to remind you all that if you stand in our way, we have an incredibly large nuclear arsenal and we'll make you experience pain you've never felt before. That's nearly a quote, Matt. Yeah. I don't even remember exactly what I wrote anymore, but it was along the, I used imagery from Ash Wednesday that the ashes of Nagasaki and Hiroshima are the ashes on the forehead of the world, and that we have to claim those as a sign of hope over and against the reality of our ability, our anthropology, our desire to prematurely turn one another into ash.
Amen.
So as the doomsday clock edges ever closer to midnight, I mean, if you can't keep it real on Ash Wednesday, like you're not going to keep it real.
Yeah. Yeah. No, for sure. Yeah. Amen. Thank you for that. I think for us this year on Ash Wednesday, I'm going to use the prophet Joel for the first time.
Joel, ever. Lump of coal.
I always love the Killers. The band, the Killers.
Yes. We got to be very clear.
To be clear. Mm-hmm. You know, I almost always use Isaiah 58, and I love Isaiah 58 for so many reasons. But for some reason, Joel just it spoke to us as we were planning for Lent this year, and it is a powerful blow the trumpet in Zion, sound the alarm on my holy mountain. Something is happening. There's a reason to pay attention. And then there is this call for the people to gather, call a solemn assembly, gather the people. And then there's this great little litany, assemble the aged, gather the children, even infants at the breast, let the bridegroom leave his room and the bride her canopy. I mean, everybody's got to, I don't care what you're doing. You need to gather with the assembly. And I feel that sense of urgency. Almost always do at Ash Wednesday, but this year, yeah, feel that urgency. And Ash Wednesday is a day of, I think, there is unholy urgency, but there's also a holy urgency. There's that fierce urgency of now. And so I think Ash Wednesday is a day of holy urgency.
We could use, well, things feel urgent. So I like it, man.
And then we begin this journey of Lent. Journey to the waters, Zach, preparing for baptism.
Mm-hmm.
I had a meeting last week with families who want to have kids baptized. We might have four or five baptisms at the Easter vigil. You know how excited that makes me?
So jealous of you, man.
I mean, there's very little to be excited in the world today. But I'll tell you one thing I'm holding on to, a little bright light out of the distance, is the possibility of an Easter vigil with four or five baptisms. That's just very, very exciting to me.
I mean, that's the mystery of the promise, though, too, right? Like,
I mean, it is.
Like, that's a part of the deal, is that in the face of the urgency and the just cosmic scale of the evil things that confront us, the Christian response is, I'm going to dunk these four kids underwater.
Yep.
And that'll be enough. That'll be enough.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. So to prepare our journey to baptism, we enter into the season of Lent. And here we have some texts for the first Sunday of Lent. I forgot. Like I remember the year A text pretty well, and then I forget the other years, especially year C. And year C begins the Old Testament text here. Is Deuteronomy 26, 1 to 11, which my congregation uses every year for Harvest Sunday, for our Caribbean Harvest Sunday. And it's this exact same reading, Deuteronomy 26, 1 to 11. When you have come into the land that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance to possess, and you possess it and settle in it, you shall take some of the first of all the fruit of the ground, which you harvest from the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you shall put it in a basket and go to the place that the Lord your God will choose as a dwelling for his name. You shall go to the priest who is in office at that time and say to him or her, today I declare to the Lord your God that I have come into the land that the Lord swore to our ancestors to give us. And when the priest takes the basket from your hand and sets it down before the altar of the Lord your God, you shall make this response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my ancestor. He went down into Egypt and lived there as an alien, few in number. And there he became a great nation, mighty and populous. When the Egyptians treated us harshly and afflicted us by imposing hard labor on us, we cried to the Lord, the God of our ancestors. And the Lord heard our voice and saw our affliction, our toil, and our oppression. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, with a terrifying display of power, and with signs and wonders. And he brought us into this place and gave us this land, a land flowing with milk and honey. So now I bring the first of the fruit of the ground that you, O Lord, have given me. You shall set it down before the Lord your God and bow down before the Lord your God. And then you, together with the Levites and the aliens who reside among you, shall celebrate with all the bounty that the Lord your God has given to you and to your house. Word of God, word of life.
Thanks be to God.
I'm so struck reading this passage this time, in light of what we've been talking about, that this is a passage about the stories that we tell ourselves about ourselves. This is the narrative through which we understand our identity, right? What are those narratives? And here's a narrative. This is the thing you're supposed to remember year after year, so that you remember who you are. I always say who you are and whose you are, and it's such a nice little phrase, but this is actually a story. Remember this story? This is your origin story. Don't forget this origin story. And so the narratives, and or you could tell yourself a different story about how you're aggrieved and Ukraine was always a part of you, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. What story you tell about yourself and about your people will shape your life and shape your future. And that's an important reminder for us as I think we begin Lent.
You know, Matt, I think it's, I'd reframe it as a destination story, more so than an origin story, because that's what it's, this is not a narrative. This is instructions for what will happen. This is what you do when you get there, that the people, even in Deuteronomy, have not yet arrived in the land of milk and honey. And so it is a beautiful picture, well written. I would forward this to my editor at the Post. It's a really pretty picture of how things will be, but the, maybe the flip to make is that's not, we're not there yet, right? They weren't there yet then, but this is the place we're going. And so as you begin, I always enjoy a good road trip and journey language. You begin Lent with a picture of your destination. That is a really full picture of the destination, and yet it's not a roadmap either. There aren't instructions for how to get there. This is just like this is where we're going. I don't know how we're going to get there, but this is a picture of things as they will be. Which holds together, right, the nice, like, I mean, that's, gosh, I just love it. The unexpected, like, mishmashing of things. That you have to tell the priest that my ancestor was a wandering Aramean who became a great mighty nation down in Egypt. And you know, your ancient Near Eastern slight cultural difference here is that people don't change in the anthropology of the ancient Near East. You are who you are. You can't pull yourselves up by the bootstraps. We hear that as like, well, he went down there with nothing and made something of himself and down in Egypt. And now look at us. But to hear that there are contradictions throughout that statement, right? That one, he's a wandering Aramean who became great and mighty. That's not really how things work. You would say like, no, he was the son of Abraham, the greatest of all. You'd want to lot up the person to make sense why they did this thing. Mm-hmm. But then if you also just pull the curtain back, he went down to Egypt and made a great nation. Don't you remember how great we were when we got kicked out and ran for our lives through the desert and have been wandering around forever? What great nation are you talking about? Are we talking about Joseph? Because he seemed to have power, but it didn't last. There's a ton of contradiction in that. And I love that like mustard seed sort of, almost Monty Python-ish tone of, look at this wonderful shrub.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about it that way. Like this story, this future, present, past, all mixed up together story, reminds me of this phrase from Dan Arlander that the baptismal waters are storied waters, right? They're waters mm-hmm. that are full of story. And this is one of those stories that we are baptized into, right? This is one of the stories that swims in those waters. But it also reminds me of the vigil itself. We'll just talk about the vigil throughout Lent because we love it that much. But where we tell stories that are sometimes a little bit weird and wild and woolly and contradictory, and we don't explain them all, actually. At the vigil, like, you preach after the mm-hmm. resurrection story, but you don't preach after every story. You just tell it. Right. it floats out there.
Yeah, you know? Don't try to preach, by the way, on all of the stories. Just as a
oh my gosh, can you imagine?
There have been an hour of stories. You don't need to like spend 3 hours explaining them to people. Yeah, and I wonder. The last thing I'll add on the text here is I wonder what it looks like to take that lens that says all of this on its face sounds good, but then it's really strange and confusing and not what I thought it would be. Let's look at that land of milk and honey promise with that same lens. If it's, cause it's probably gonna have that same character that is unexpected and not. Land of milk and honey sounds good, but it's probably gonna also be just as unexpected as the rest of the story there.
Indeed. Romans,
this is real Paul here this week in a segment we like to call the Robert Adam Burnt Epistle of the Week. We're in Romans 10. We're just jumping all over the place. I wonder, I've not done the work, Matt. I'm sure some of our faithful, hardworking preachers know what next week's epistle would be. I don't know if we're going to hang out in Romans for a while, but we're starting in chapter 10. The word is near to you. It's on your lips and in your heart. That is the word of faith that we proclaim, just to be clear. Paul couldn't help himself. He had to explain. Because if you confess with your lips that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For one who believes with the heart and is so justified, and one who confesses with the mouth and so is saved. The scripture says, no one who believes in him will be put to shame, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek. The same Lord is Lord of all and generous to all who call on him. For everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. Oh. What a reading for the week, Matt. There's no distinction between Judeans and Grecians and Ukrainians. Oh, in a week when we are drawn to our national, cultural, ethnic identities, when those are lifted up and made plain before us. This is a different version of anthropology here.
Yeah, I'll take a short, I'll try to keep a short detour. I've been reading Amy Jelavine's The Misunderstood Jew and some of her just fascinating coverage. That book came out, I think, our first year of seminary. And so a lot of it, like, it's interesting. It's really interesting to hear her take. But she talks about this. There's another place where this shows up in the New Testament, but this no distinction between Jew and Greek. And she finds that to be a, like, not entirely helpful strategy that Paul takes in his argumentation, because it usually what that does is it erases one of the, anybody that's worked in a multicultural setting, right? Usually you just erase one culture and try to subsume everyone into this.
We're all capitalists now. That's not, we all got McDonald's.
Happening. Yeah. 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 I mean, usually if we're trying to be colorblind, usually what we're doing is trying to subsume everyone into a white culture. Like that's usually what we're doing. And that can be true here too. Like we have to be careful of that danger, I think, when we're reading stuff like No Distinction Jew and Greek. And yet there is this, like, there is this deep truth to it underneath it. And so it's, yeah, how do you walk into this with this awareness that like there are these deep cultural differences that that we need to have some humility before, both whether it's Jew and Greek or East and West in the world today, or however you want to approach that, but then also to recognize this same Lord is Lord of all, this sense that we just remembered on Ash Wednesday that we all come from ash and will return to the dust, that both things can be true.
Just as complex as the is the Deuteronomy, as plain as it looks, right? Luke, Matt, Luke 4, we're jumping back, I think, because we were on top of a mountain in chapter 9 last week, and now we're bouncing back to 4. What has just happened, which is important to note, is that Jesus was just baptized. A loud voice boomed from the heavens. The clouds parted. This is my son, the beloved, with whom I'm well pleased, or something like that. And then immediately, Jesus, the one who is well pleased, is sent into the wilderness, led by the Spirit. Jesus does not choose to do this of his own volition. He's kind of literally blown into the wilderness, which again, I remind you, wilderness in the Bible, not a fun place for like recreation, but a place where the stakes are very high and life and death is a challenge.
So he wasn't visiting a national park?
He did not get a single stamp. One of the things the Romans were great, Matt. Aqueducts, security, sanitation, all that stuff, great. Did not have a national park system. That was the downfall, some people say. I've listened to that History of Rome podcast. It's like 18 trillion hours, and that's where they end up. Not a lot of people make it into that podcast. The downfall of the Roman Empire was their lack of a suitable national park system.
Yep. America's best idea.
So Jesus not going to the national park, because I don't think you can camp at a national park in the same spot at least for 40 days. I think you're limited, right, Matt?
I think so. Yeah, I've never tried to stay that long, but I think so.
You can't just go like live in the national park. But while there, he was tempted by the devil, the accuser. He ate nothing at all during those days. Pretty hungry, and he was famished afterwards. I like that little detail. Like, he was starving at the end of it. But never mind. We'll keep going, is what the writer says. They don't say that he went to McDonald's in Moscow. The devil said to him, "If you are the Son of God," and that's where I'd like to focus the text, Matt, that on the heels of these two readings, and, you know, as a campus pastor, vocation and identity is a thing that I see in everything, but I think it's a thread that you can weave through all of these, that in the Deuteronomy, you got to say, my ancestor was a wandering Aramaean. The Romans text is all about Jew or Greek identity pieces here, and that the devil, the accuser's questions here is a challenge to Jesus' identity. If you are the Son of God, right, if you are who the voice of the heaven from heaven said that you are, command the stone to become a loaf of bread. And Jesus answered him, it is written, one does not live by bread alone. Then the devil led him up and showed him in an instant all the kingdoms of the world. And the devil said to him, I will give you their glory. And I will give you all this authority, for it's been given over to me, and I can give it to anyone I please. If you then will worship me, if you choose, so it's not as explicit here, but it is an identity question. If you will have me as your patron rather than God as your patron, because if you'll take the stuff that I give you, that means you belong to me, and it changes your identity. If you then will worship me, it'll all be yours. And Jesus answered him, it is written, worship the Lord your God and serve only him. And so then the devil took him to Jerusalem, placed him up on the pinnacle of the temple, saying to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here. For it is written that he will command his angels concerning you to protect you, and on their hands they will bear you up, and so that you will not dash your foot against a stone. And Jesus answered him, it is said, do not put the Lord your God to the test. And when the devil finished every test, he departed from him until an opportune time. Gosh, I love the foreshadowing. It is fun.
So good.
Mm-hmm. Not just so he departed good. From him. He departed from him until an opportune time. That's how I conclude all of my council meetings and board meetings. I'm now departing from you until an opportune time.
Mm-hmm. I'll just do that, like, email sign off until an opportune time.
Please, vinyl preachers, somebody send me an email this week where you sign off. I will read whatever you write in that email live to tape on the air if you sign it off until an opportune time and then your name. Go in peace to love and serve the Lord until an opportune time. Thanks be to God.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. I think complexity ties together here, Matt, that the devil here is presenting if you are who you are, then this is what it means. And Jesus is adding these layers of complexity that if you can take the question seriously, like it doesn't feel like super, they don't seem super unreasonable as questions, right? Like if God is the God of abundance and can do miraculous things and that God feeds the 5,000, let's turn these rocks to bread.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet Jesus still says that to us, right? Like, which is frustrating. Like, can Jesus's answers, it's very frustrating.
Jesus is frustrating?
Yeah. Jesus, real pain. I think you could go with the whole angle of having us ask the question somewhat reasonably. And hearing Jesus' response to us could be an interesting way to do that. Mm-hmm. That the questions can be, I've heard real humans ask these questions before, right? Like, why are people hungry? Why are people starving? Why are people dying in needless war? If God is all powerful, right? The somewhat sillier one, right, that a student used to ask me is, could God make a burrito so hot that even God couldn't eat it? Sort of thing, which is the last question.
Yep. Sounds like my philosophy classes. Oh my God, what a fun time. I mean, it is, yeah, that there's this this question and answer, this, we don't usually think about it as a dialogue, but there's a way in which it's a dialogue. But that this has to happen. Like the Spirit leads Jesus into this time of testing, into this time of back and forth, into this time of dialogue, into this time of argument, however you want to like frame that. And that's this important part of his journey. That's an important part of how it gets started. And the same could be true for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's helpful too, that this is the start of his journey. And this is the start of our
until an opportune journey. Time is going to happen again. He's going to get tested again and again.
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. Maybe I'd make that my good news statement, that an opportune time is coming. That it will, that these texts are full of what will be, and that we are full of what will be, and that full experience of the new life that God is bringing into the world is first and foremost and primarily experiential as we look towards the vigil. But that my words of promise for the week would be, there is an opportune time ahead.
Amen. Well, what are we listening to during this opportune time?
I think there's no better way to start Lent than with a Christmas song, Matt. And so I sang it facetiously. I'm going to go. I think it's great. I think it's a great way to start Lent and Ash Wednesday. I'm going to go with the Killers song, Joel, the Lump of Coal. That is a Christmas song from the perspective of a lump of coal who takes exception with being like the thing that bad kids get. And it takes you into the perspective of Cole, and it reimagines what Cole might be about. And so as we're reimagining the ashes and looking for a promise that's buried among the ashes, perhaps here in the perspective of our good friend Joel, the lump of coal, would be a good thing to hear. And I'm going to go with Matt. This year, this past year, 2021, is the year that my family got heavily involved in Eurovision, the song contest. And my favorite song, my favorite performance in the whole thing was from the Ukrainian band Go_A, and they had a song called Shum, and you should all check it out. Maybe I'll put it on. I think I photoshopped Matt into it one time, right after Eurovision, where I put Matt on stage with them, and they are everything that you would hope that Ukrainian like popular music would be, like and about some version of steampunk crossed with Game of Thrones, crossed with seasonally affective depression, which is right up in my fields. But the song that they entered into last year's Eurovision contest is a song called Shum, and it was performed entirely in Ukrainian, which is a, gosh, I can't wait. And I'm excited and disappointed that I'm currently scheduled to be in Europe during the Eurovision final. And my wife just found out about it, and she's not happy because we were going to do a big thing, but we're going to get Caleb Craner on. We're going to find some Europeans. I've got some European friends. We're going to get on because a lot happens in the Eurovision song contest, man. And it was a bold choice to sing a song in Ukrainian because you're not going to win. Like, you're just not going to win the song contest because most people in Europe do not speak Ukrainian. And so as this conflict is blowing up about, like, the idea that Ukrainians are right, like, it's a bold choice and such a powerful choice to choose knowingly, right? Like, choose not to win in order to sing in Ukrainian is a powerful thing. It's a great song. And when you do the translation, Matt, when you get it into English, it's a song that I think works this week. It's called Shum, or pronounced Shum, I guess, in transliterated English. But the chorus is sowing, 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 sowing hemp plants, sowing, 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 sowing green ones. Come spring, come. Don't wait around. We'll go outside to love each other. We'll spring our miss. And it's a song about what will be. And it's an old Ukrainian folk song that they have like repurposed into this that you can just hear the generations of folks who live in a place where the return of spring is a really hopeful, life-giving thing that probably very often feels like it'll never happen. And so my song for the playlist this week for the people of Ukraine this week is Shum by Go_A.
Love it. Well done. Way to choose a Ukrainian song. Your love of Eurovision comes through. Ugh. I'll throw on I listened to U2's War album this morning, which of course is beloved by Adam Scott and Scott Aukerman. It's an actual good album all the way through.
It's a good one.
All the way through. So I'll do U2's Seconds. That's the one I'll pick. Lesser known, deeper cut. And then I feel like I've got to do some, I got to get caught up on these Coachella artists, Zach, because Coachella is coming up after Easter.
It's not so, yet, but it will be Coachella, the land of milk and honey. We're going to walk through the deserts.
It's on the other side of the vigil for sure. So I'll throw on, Yola, who's an amazing, kind of folky artist. She was actually on that High Women single.
She is her
own artist and has so a couple good. Of albums, and she's really good. So I'm gonna put her a song called Hold On. It's by Yola, and it's really good, and she's on the Coachella playlist. So I assume that means she's playing a Coachella. I'm gonna have to check the artist poster again.
Get your playlist. Get your magnifying glass out.
Yeah, Zach, I feel like I gotta, even though you've put this on the playlist 8 million times, it does feel like another week for Phoebe Bridgers, that funny feeling.
Oh my gosh, I was just listening.
Another week where it just feels appropriate.
Gosh, she better play it. I just am praying to the gods of singer-songwriters everywhere that at Coachella Phoebe will do that funny feeling for us. Please, Phoebe.
Well, Zach, it's been real opportune.
real, you know, before we leave, man, I think it's worth saying that, dear listener, you might find an opportune time to head over to www.patreon.com/thevinylpreacher to become a vinyl preacher or a Patreon. You could either do it now or you could wait until an opportune time. But I think right now is probably the most opportune time.
Maybe you'll get some t-shirts one day.
Maybe you'll get Ukrainian vinyl preacher shirts.